Good evening, everyone. We're back for the third lecture of Austrian macroeconomics, and we'll begin where I left off last week. Just to quickly review, the purchasing power or value of money is determined by the supply and demand for money, like any other good. So we see on this particular graph that the demand for money, which increases as the value of money declines, that is, as prices go up and people need more, and people have to pay higher prices, they need to hold more money. And so therefore we see that the quantity demanded of money increases. Okay. So if the price were $4, you would need about roughly twice as much money as you would if the price was $2. Okay, taking the price of something like an ice cream cone or a can of soda or something like that as a representative good. So the higher the prices are, the lower the purchasing power of money is. That is, the less of each good a dollar buys, the more dollars that you need to keep on hand for your present and anticipated future purchases. So that's how the supply and demand for money are determined. Okay. If the Fed sets it at $1,000, well then if prices were much lower, okay, for example, if the price of this representative good were only $1, then people, there would be much more money available than there would be the demand for money. So people might only demand $500 to hold in this economy to pay these low prices of a dollar. But as prices went up, okay, as they went out and rushed out and tried to spend the new money, then what would occur is that there would be an adjustment. And we'll talk a little bit more about the adjustment process when we talk about inflation. That is, as people spend the extra money that they have on hand, that increases the demand for goods, raises prices, and new set of people get the money, and they rush out and spend it, and they in turn push up prices with their extra spending until all prices have risen to the point where every dollar in the economy is now held, is now desired, so that we can have so that they have sufficient dollars to make their planned purchases. Anything that's more than that, any time it's excess money, if you win a lottery or something like that, you don't keep it all on hand. You rush out and spend a lot of it. And hold only what you think you'll need until to spend on your various purchases until the next pay period or the next time that you have income. So let's move on from there. This is the example of inflation. Now let's say that the Fed, and we'll talk about the Fed tonight in a little bit more detail, increases the money supply from $1,000 to $2,000. And it can do that, as we'll see, the various tools that it uses to do that. It can do that very easily. So it doubles the amount of money in the economy. The supply of money increases from $1,000 to $2,000. People at the old price level of $2, okay, and if you look at the price level, it's here on the right axis. At that old price level, they only need the whole $1,000 to make the purchases that they plan. But when you double the amount of money, they now have an extra $1,000. So people rush out to spend it. That drives prices up, and as prices rise towards $4, okay, you see the price increasing towards $4, the purchasing power of each dollar is cut in half. Each dollar buys less goods. So you have to hold more dollars in order to get the same amount of purchasing power. So you move from point A, which we have right here, down to point B. So all the increase in supply of money has succeeded in doing, and we'll talk more about this also, is to increase prices in the economy and cause the purchasing power of the dollar to shrink, okay, in the long run. Now, there are other consequences, which we'll talk about. But at the first approximation, an increase in supply of money, all other things equal, will raise prices and cut the purchasing power of money. So let's go on from here. This is the adjustment process that I talked about. We can call it the inflation adjustment process. I have a short version here, and then on the next slide I have a little bit longer version. So at the prevailing level of prices, the Fed increases the money supply. The Fed is in complete control of the fiat money supply. And that causes an excess supply of money. just as when you suddenly get a bonus from work or, as I said, you win a lottery. You're not going to hold all that money. You're going to spend some of it on consumption, and you're going to spend some of it on interest-bearing investments. So as you get people get rid of their excess money by spending it, okay, they spend it on G&S, which are goods and services, or they can loan it to others who then in turn spend it, they increase the demand for goods throughout the economy. And that's what drives prices up. And of course, without any more production in the economy, and there's no reason why there should be any more production, you have the same supply of goods. So on all markets in the economy, prices rise, and therefore the purchasing power of money falls, and people need to hold a greater amount of money. Eventually you reach what we call an equilibrium, and the amount of money in the economy is just sufficient for people to make their planned purchases. And now let me go to a symbolic illustration of this process. And so here's what happens when you have an excess supply of money. Okay, so the money supply, MS, is greater than the money demand. People have more money than they want to hold at the current level of prices. So the sideways arrow indicates that it causes an increase in the demand for goods, e.g., which in turn causes prices to rise. People rush out to spend the excess money. And the other side of the coin, the purchasing power of money falls, each dollar buys less, people have to hold more dollars, so the quantity demanded of dollars increases. Obviously, if gasoline was now $8 instead of $4, and lunch instead of costing an average of $10 a day is $20 a day, you're going to need to hold more dollars. You have to walk around with more dollars or have more dollars in your checking account and so on. And so eventually, the quantity demand of money will rise to the point where all of that extra money is absorbed. That is, people want to hold all the extra money. So the final position, the equilibrium position, is that money supply plus money demand. And that's the final set of symbols. And on the other hand, if for some reason, let's say people are more uncertain about the future, and or they think that they may lose their job or that they won't get their bonus, what they're going to do then is to demand more money, say in the face of some sort of a looming recession or some other kind of catastrophe. The demand for money usually goes up. People want cash. And so now the money supply that's in existence that the Fed provided is actually less than that is demanded by people. Now here's where the Keynesians jump in and say, aha, how are people going to get this additional money that they need? Okay, we have to jump in and increase the supply of money. Okay, otherwise there'll be a fall in demand for goods, won't go into a recession. Well, they're right, there will be a fall in demand for goods. You see that, the downward arrow for the demand for goods. But the point is the market will adjust the purchasing power of money. It will make each dollar more powerful. Each dollar will be able to purchase more. So you'll have a fall in prices as people withhold spending or don't spend as much as in the past. But at that point, the purchasing power of money will go up. Each dollar will buy more. So let's assume that people want twice as much money as they did before because of uncertainty. Prices will roughly be cut in half, and purchasing power of money will rise. Each dollar will buy more and more, and they'll therefore need less. That is the same $1,000. Okay? Let's assume they thought they needed $2,000. The Fed only supplied $1,000, but the same $1,000 at the lower prices, when prices are half as high, we'll purchase twice as much. So in effect, the market increases what we call the real supply of money. Each dollar is worth twice as much. Each dollar can buy twice as much pizza and so on. So you don't need to hold as many. So people will then become satisfied with $1,000, whereas before they wanted $2,000. Why? Because each dollar has doubled in purchasing power when prices have fallen. And so you get the final equilibrium position of money supply equals money demand. Which brings us then to this age-old question that has vexed economists and caused a lot of controversy among economists since the beginning, the founding of economics, actually going back even further than Adam Smith. People have argued over the proper supply of money. One of the first inflationists, and not surprisingly, the first central banker, John Law, who was the head of the Central Bank of France, the Royal Bank of France, wrote a book in 1705 in which he claimed that anytime you saw any unemployment or anytime you saw any idle capacity, any farmers' fields that were idle and not being used, the problem was that there was too little money, that there wasn't enough money, that the money wasn't being properly supplied. And he was against the gold standard. And he was one of the first economists to favor paper money, and he introduced it, paper money, when he was the central bank president, as I said, in France. And, of course, that destroyed the French currency. But anyway, you have to ask yourself, why would economists even ask this question? Okay, and now they put it in a much more scientific way. They don't talk about the proper supply of money. They talk about the optimal supply of money. And why should they talk? Why should they raise this question? Why should they debate this question? Think about this question and write so much on it when no one writes about the optimal supply of pizzas or iPads or automobiles. For the most part, economists tend to believe that the market will determine through profit and losses and the amount and the buying and abstention from buying by consumers will determine the proper supplies of the various goods and services. Okay, so if there's too much of one good being supplied, not enough of another, the good which is in excess supply, its price will fall. The firms will suffer losses. On the other hand, price will shoot up for those goods which are undersupplied by the market, and there'll be profits, and there'll be a shift of resources throughout the economy so that fewer of the oversupplied goods are being produced and more of the goods that are very scarce will be produced. Okay, so why should they worry about the proper supply of money? And how would an Austrian respond to this? I mean, what would an Austrian say about the proper supply of money? Before we can answer that question, we have to look at the difference between money and other goods. And money is a good that people, as we point out, supply and demand. People buy money and sell money. When you go to work, or if you sell something on eBay, you're buying money. Okay? When you purchase something, you're selling money. So we're all dealers in money. We all regularly buy and sell money. So so money's a good. Now, how is money different from capital goods, those things that are used in an economy to produce consumer goods? Well, almost all capital goods are used up in production, including factories, raw materials. You know, factories are depreciated over time. Means of transportation like airplanes and trucks and FedEx warehouses and so on. All those things are used up over time. Okay, and they're used up in producing something that has hopefully more value to consumers, and that's the final consumer's goods. Okay, so you use up the oil rig, and you use up the oil that goes into producing gasoline, right? And so production doesn't destroy capital goods, but it transforms them into consumer goods of greater value. And secondly, what about consumer goods? Consumer goods themselves are destroyed by consumption. One economist, J.B. Say, always talked about consumption as synonymous with destruction. When you increase consumption, you increase the destruction of goods. And yes, that's true. It does increase the physical destruction of goods, but in doing so, it yields utility or satisfaction to the individuals that are engaging in the consumption. So we're not saying consumption isn't a good thing. It's a very, very good thing. It's, in fact, the very reason that we have an economy. It's for consumption. Okay. But money is different than both capital goods, or different from both capital goods and consumer goods. And by the way, we also include under capital goods, we might want to broaden that and call it producer's goods. Okay, so land is the producer's good, much land is the producer's good, and that is one of the few goods that is not used up, though agricultural land is certainly used up. You have to keep replenishing it, and putting more fertilizer on it, more topsoil and so on. So even land is a capital good that is worn out. But in any case, let's get back to money. So money, remember we said, is the general medium of exchange. Okay, and when you perform this function, money is not destroyed. Okay, it doesn't have to be destroyed. Okay, it is incidentally worn down sometimes. Coins wear a little bit. Paper money wears out, has to be replaced every 3 years. But in performing its function, it doesn't have to be destroyed. Okay, unlike capital goods and consumer goods, which are scarce and are used up in the process of production and consumption. In fact, all you need money for is to pass it on to someone else, okay, for something that you desire more. So you regularly accept money for things you sell and then pass it on to someone else for the things that you wish to buy. So money is not destroyed. So we have what we call an angel, before I get to that model, Ricardo's law, right? Because money is not destroyed in the economy, it means that you don't need any more than you have at any given moment of time. So you can state Ricardo's law. David Ricardo, a British economist living in the early 19th century, was sort of a proto-Austrian in monetary theory. Okay, he didn't have a good value theory. He believed in the cost of production as determining price. So he wasn't an Austrian in all respects. But what he said with regard the conclusion he came to with regard to the money supply was that if you increase it, it really doesn't confer any benefit on society, okay? Because the purchasing power of money is always adjusted by the market so that all the goods that people benefit by buying and selling in the economy can be bought and sold with any supply of money, okay? So if you have twice the supply of money in one economy as you do in another, but otherwise the economies are exactly the same, they have the exact same labor force, the same amount of capital goods, same population, who have the same tastes and so on, to keep everything the same, but you just change the amount of money, there's no difference in the satisfaction that people in the two economies receive. In fact, the people in the economy with twice the money supply have to pay twice the prices, okay? Whereas the people in the economy with only one half of the money supply only pay one half the prices. So basically, the real money supply is the same, right? So whether you have $1,000 in the economy or $2,000, in the economy where you have $2,000, you're paying twice the price. So your $2,000 doesn't have any more value than the $1,000 at the lower prices. So therefore, any supply of money is sufficient to yield the full benefits of the medium of exchange. And one of the reasons for that is that if you go back to the capital goods, consumer goods, and money, capital goods, if you double the supply of capital goods in the economy, that does increase people's welfare. You have more factories, more raw materials, more labor services. Then, in fact, what happens is that you double the amount of consumer goods that you produce, and therefore that satisfies more human wants, and human beings are better off. And by the same token, if you directly double the amount of consumers' goods in the economy, then that will increase welfare by increasing or satisfying more human wants. But that's not true with money, as we see. Okay, and we'll go into more detail about that now. So this is the so-called helicopter model. Milton Friedman called it the helicopter model. Murray Rothbard called it the Angel Gabriel model. And I like the Angel Gabriel model as a term better. Not because I like necessarily, I like Rothbard better than Friedman, obviously, as a monetary economist. But because I think it's actually more accurate in what it's trying to convey. Because if you just spread money across the landscape with a helicopter, you don't increase everybody's money proportionally. And that's what we want to do in this sort of mental experiment. So let's assume that there's an angel who doesn't know any economics. He never took Austrian macroeconomics or any other courses. But he is very benevolent, and the angel Gabriel, wants to help human beings. And he notices that every time one person gets more money, that person is better off. That person buys more goods and services. So, not knowing economics, he thinks that, well, if he increases the amount of money that everybody has, well, then everybody would be better off, okay? So, what does he do? So, he doubles everybody's cash balance. Remember, the cash balance is the amount of money that each individual person owns, that they are holding in cash or they have in their check plus what they have in a checking account and other bank accounts. So as soon as everybody wakes up the next day, if you think back to those graphs that we were showing before, suddenly they have twice the amount of money. But prices haven't changed overnight. So everybody has excess cash balances, or there's an excess supply of money. So everyone rushes out and spends it, and prices double. So I'll give an example here. This will have no effect on the real supply of money. People have twice as much money, but prices will be twice as high. No one will be better off. Everyone will have twice the amount of wages. So all prices go up, so the wages will be twice as high, the prices will be twice as high. So no one is better off. And in fact, as I note here, the second sub-bullet, the effect on the real supply of money, which is the amount of money in the economy divided by the price of goods. So in our economy, we had the money supply was $1,000. Pizza, let's say, is really good. It's $10 for pizza. So the real supply of money is 100 pizzas. You divide 10 pizzas, rather $10 per pizza into $1,000, and you then are left with 100 pizzas as the amount of pizzas that can be purchased by $1,000 at price of $10 each. So let's say all prices were doubled, and the money supply was doubled. Now the numerator would have $2,000, that would be 2,000, but the denominator, price of pizzas, would be $20. Price would have doubled, and so therefore 2,000 divided by $20 per pizza is 100 pizzas. So the real money supply doesn't change. So the angel Gabriel has not left human beings better off. He could have done this if he doubled the amount of cars they had in their driveways, or if he doubled the amount of factories in the economy, or doubled the amount of software programs. All of those things would have led eventually or right away to more consumers' goods, and people would have been better off. But doubling the medium of exchange does not make people better off, okay? And that's what Ricardo's law tells us. But there's actually an argument to be made that the angel could have made some people worse off and others better off. Okay, because we assume that everybody got up at the same time and noticed that their cash balances had doubled, and they all rushed out at the same time and tried to buy goods and services. But let's say that some people get up early, and they notice this right away, and they rush out, and you know, people get up at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, they rush out, and they spend the extra money. So prices begin to rise. And then there's some people get up just a little bit later than that, and they find prices have risen somewhat. They still have more money, and they can pay those higher prices and maybe even buy some extra goods. But then, at sort of what people get up around noon or whatever, or people work the night shift, they get up and they find that prices have already almost doubled, and they rush out and spend, and they don't really get any benefit. In fact, prices could have shot up above the extra money that they got, and so therefore they actually lose money. Okay, so they have to pay higher prices. So income has been shifted from people who get the new money later on to people who got the new money early on. Those are the people who get the real increase in their purchasing power. Okay, by the time the people get up late, get to the market, you know, prices have already doubled or more than doubled on some markets. Okay. Now here's an outline of a map of New York City, and I want to show you what would happen when the government prints more money. Okay, because the government is not the angel Gabriel. The government does not double or triple or increase proportionally everybody's cash balances. Some people get the new money first. Some people get it much later, and some people don't get it at all. Okay. So let's start in Washington, D.C. there, where the government is printing dollars, okay? Or let's say the Fed, which is in New York, actually prints the dollars up and allows the government to spend more money than they're taking in taxes. So here we have government printing dollars, actually the Fed printing dollars, and the government receiving these dollars from the Fed, and then beginning to spend them. So let's say, here's the government, the U.S. government, and let's say they want to buy more computers here from Silicon Valley SV in order to, say military computers to guide missiles and so on. So they print this new money, and the first people to get it are the stockholders of these firms in Silicon Valley, the owners, and the workers. So price of computers begin to go up. Okay, so I'm back in let's say New York City, New Jersey rather, up here. I work in New York City and at Pace University, and I don't get any of that new money. But now the price of computers is starting to go up. Well, I might not be in the market for a new computer, so I'll be hurt too badly. But some people will be hurt because they don't have any of the new money yet. Now the people who have, from Silicon Valley, let's say the owners buy more Napa Valley wine, so the price of wine begins to rise. So you see Napa Valley above Silicon Valley there. And then others, let's say other the workers, buy more beer from Milwaukee here. So now people who own the breweries and their workers, as well as people in the wineries, okay, the vintners and their workers, they don't have this new money, okay? And now, so price, and in the meantime, price of beer and of wine has gone up. And so I'm back here in New York, I haven't gotten any of the new money, and now I'm starting to get nervous because prices of the things I buy are going up, wine and beer and so on. But it doesn't stop there, of course, because people now have excess cash balances in Napa Valley and in Milwaukee. And let's assume they go out and they spend on, they buy more steak dinners, okay? So they go and they spend the money, on beef from the meat packers in Chicago. They get the new money, okay? Restaurant price is starting to go up because beef has gone up throughout the country. So now more and more people who don't have any of the new money are beginning to be hurt by the rising prices. And we could go on and on with this, but let's say all of these people then, maybe buy more, new money, buy Florida Beach condos, okay? And so the price of Florida Beach condos start to go up. I'll come back to that. And they begin to increase the demand for financial services, so they invest some of this money in New York City. So maybe it's now 18 months later, whatever it is, when the price of the financial services go up and firms in the financial sector are doing better, they then are willing to pay more for their employees to get MBA education by teaching an MBA program right near Wall Street at Pace University. And so finally, after 18 months, 24 months, my salary goes up. But for that year and a half or 2 years, I've had to pay higher prices for automobiles, beer, meat, wine, and so on. So I've had, me and others like me, have had resources transferred from, real resources transferred from me to those who got the new money first, to the government itself, and then who got the computers, and then, of course, the people who got the new money early on in the process. The people who got the new money only as the price has risen have actually been hurt. Their real income has been decreased for that year and a half or 2 years. They've had to pay higher prices, but yet they don't have any, they don't have the extra money to pay them those higher prices. So they cut back on their standard of living. And then some people don't get it at all. And let's say there are people, retired people living on fixed incomes who want to buy Florida beach condos or rent down in Florida. Well, they're stuck because they're on a fixed income and they never get any of the new money. So they're permanently injured. And so this is an Austrian analysis of inflation as opposed to a monetarist analysis, whereas the monetarist would say, well, money supply doubles and prices double, and pretty much no one's any better or worse off. But, of course, that's not true, okay? Otherwise, the government would not inflate money supply, okay? If no one was better off, why should the government inflate money supply? So certain people are better off, the ones that get the government money first, the favorites of the government, the special interests, and others are worse off. People on fixed incomes and other people who only have only have the prices of the things they sell increase later on. So my salary goes up 2 years later, finally, when there's a greater demand for an MBA education on the part of people in the financial industry. So I think that's, and by the way, the effects of counterfeiting are exactly the same, okay, and we're not talking ethically here, we mean economically, as they are for inflation. So if people in, I tell my students, if everyone had paid, we had a secret machine printing money in the gymnasium or in the sub-basement of my university, we would all be enriched, and then we would go around to the local restaurants and shops and so on, coffee shops and so on. We'd spend this extra money, prices would rise, and the people on Wall Street who have not gotten any of this new money and who eat the same shops and restaurants and everything else, drink coffee there and so on, they would find their prices going up, okay? And then they would have the new money. Then eventually the money would spread throughout New York City, and then people in New York would now have coming over to New Jersey and buying, going to the malls in New Jersey and buying more clothing and so on, going to more boutiques. Prices would go up for those things, and people in New Jersey now would have to pay higher prices until they got some of the money, to the extent that they were working for those firms that had the additional spending from New York. So counterfeiting in its economic effects, as I said, is no different than inflation. Okay. So now I want to get into banking, okay, because we want to know, how does the Fed actually increase the money supply? Okay, does it really just print money? When Ben Bernanke was on when he did his interview, I think it was on 2020, 2 years ago, to justify some of the Fed's policies and to become more transparent. He denied that the Fed printed money, and technically he was correct, but of course he was lying. I mean, they do create money out of thin air, though they don't necessarily print it. That only happens after the money supply begins to increase, that when people demand cash instead of checking account money, which is how the Fed does increase the money supply, then the Fed will trade some of have the Fed Treasury print up the cash and then trade the cash for the checking accounts that people are trading in to withdraw cash. So let's look at bank reserves. So we're going to be talking about a fraction reserve banking system, wherein the bank only keeps a fraction of the deposits on reserve. Okay. So in the U.S., legally, they have to keep 10% on reserve. Okay. Currently, they keep much more than 10% of deposits on reserve. They're holding what we call excess reserves, because they're being paid to do so by the Fed. They're getting 0.25% interest. Plus, they don't see a lot of really good creditworthy businesses and investment projects out there, though that's beginning to change. So the Fed establishes reserve requirements, which are regulations on the minimum amount of reserves the bank has to hold against deposits. And that, as I said today, is legally 10%. So it's effectively much less than 10% because it's something called sweep accounts, which they don't want to go into, where they can take the money out of your deposits, your checking accounts, and put them in sort of savings account type vehicle overnight. And that reduces the amount of reserves they have to hold. But just let me put that aside. They hold 10%, let's say. And they may hold more if they wish, and that's called excess reserves. So the reserve ratio, which we symbolize by capital R, can be defined as the fraction of deposits that the bank holds as reserves. Okay, so it's total reserves as a percentage of total deposits. So it's total reserves divided by total deposits. So if in the banking system you have $1,000 of checking deposits, then and $100 of reserves, backing those $1,000 up, then we say the reserve ratio is 10%. If you have $200 backing up that $1,000, then we say the reserve requirement is 20%. And if the reserve ratio is 20%, excuse me, if the reserve requirement is only 10%, then we say that the banks are holding 10% excess reserves. 10% more than they need to hold. Okay. They only need to hold $100 to hold $200. So let's go through a very simplified balance sheet, which we call the bank T account, okay, and see how the new checking account money is created by the Fed. Okay. So, for example, let's say the Fed holds $100 of deposits. Those are considered liabilities. That's money that the Fed owes to creditors, that owes to the depositors. Okay, they owe the depositors $100. That's their liability. The depositors come in, they can withdraw up to $100 in cash from the bank, so it's a liability. The Fed then uses those deposits to make loans, interest-bearing loans. So that's an asset because that's money that is owed to them. Or to hold in reserves. That's also an asset because that's cash on hand, and that is an asset. So the bank's liabilities include not just deposits, but they also issue bonds, and they also borrow from the Fed and so on. But we'll just take, for the simplified account, deposits as their only liability. Okay. So in this example, notice that the reserve ratio is 10%. And so they're holding no excess reserves. So now we have this example of supposing there's $100 of currency in circulation, okay? What's the bank's impact on the money supply? Okay, well, we're going to take three different cases. The first is that there's no banking system. Well, without a banking system, there's simply $100 in the money supply, okay? The money supply totals $100. And you get that by simply adding up everybody's cash balances. And since we don't have a banking system, everybody now holds their cash balances in the form of currency. Okay, if assuming it's a paper money system, they're holding paper money. And we'll take the second example, which is where you have 100% reserves, okay, where the bank must by law hold the full amount of its deposits on hand in its vaults or ATMs today. Which means they can't make any loans. So under 100% fractional reserve banking system, banks are really not intermediaries. They're not borrowing money from one group and lending to another. They're in fact warehouses. They're just storing money for people. Okay, sort of like a furniture warehouse that stores people's furniture when people leave on vacation, or like storage units, which store extra stuff that people can't fit in their homes. No one is permitted to use, the storage unit cannot begin renting some of that stuff out, let's say some of the furniture out, or bicycles are stored there, they can't rent those things out, that would be embezzlement, and they'd be prosecuted. And then finally, let's look at the fractional reserve banking system. So case one, no banking system, the public holds $100 worth of currency, so therefore the money supply is $100. I don't have to belabor that point. In case two, we have 100% reserve banking system. So if you look here at the deposits, they're 100, the liability is 100, and on the asset side, the reserves are $100. There are no and can be no loans in the case of 100% reserve banking system. Okay, the money supply does not increase though. Even though you have $100 of additional deposits in the system, you've taken out $100 of cash that has been deposited and held in the vaults of the bank. So as Ludwig von Mises would say, under a 100% fractional reserve banking or under 100% banking system, the deposits are money certificates. That is, they substitute in exchange dollar for reserves. So they're money substitutes. Okay. They don't add to the money supply. As we'll see in the next example, money substitutes can add to the money supply to the extent that they're not dollar for dollar substitutes for reserves. And loans are zero. Okay, so even in the 100% reserve banking system, there is no effect on the money supply of issuing checking accounts. And I'm not going to go into the ethical side of all of this. Okay. I will say, though, that fractional reserve banking began or originated in fraud, okay? That is, that the reserves were secretly, surreptitiously lent out, or part of the reserves were lent out by the bank. That is, a part of the deposits were lent out. And when the deposits found this out, there was a run on the bank, and the bank would fail, okay? And the goldsmith, if the goldsmith was holding people's gold, the gold standard, would be subject to prosecution. Okay, then the number of laws changed, and by the early 1800s, fractional reserve banking was legal. It's not ethical, but I'm not going to talk about that question at all. Okay, so now we have case three. Okay, so here the reserve requirement, which is the legally required amount of reserves that must be held, a percentage of deposits that must be held on reserve, is 10%. Okay, so the bank in a normal situation would lend out of $190. Okay, they would lend that out at interest. And that is the incentive for lending it out, because when you hold money in a vault, you don't earn interest on it. So initially, banks that were hiding the fact that they were lending part of the gold out were actually earning a fee for storing the gold and then an extra amount of money in interest, and that was their incentive. So depositors now have $100 in deposits, but borrowers have $90 in currency. The bank has lent out, let's assume they lend it out in currency, they've lent out $90 in currency. So now you have circulating in the economy. Okay, so money supply is currency plus deposits, C plus D. And therefore you have $90 in currency and $100 in checking account money. Okay? So the money supply suddenly increased by 90%. It shot up. And all other things equal, prices will tend to rise by 90%. Okay? The people who get the new money first, the borrowers, will be the ones that have benefit from this and have an increase in their real income, whereas the others who have not borrowed the money will find that suddenly prices are higher and they have to buy less with their income because they can't buy the same amount with the higher prices. Oops, sorry. Okay. So go on with case three here. You see some of the implications. How does the money supply suddenly grow? Anytime a fractional reserve bank makes a loan, it immediately increases the money supply. Okay, so it immediately lends out currency that is now part of the money supply. Okay, while the original depositors have the full amount of the money they've deposited on deposit and can draw on that by writing checks. So the borrower gets the $90 in currency, which is an asset, okay, for the borrower, and that's counting the money supply. Okay, they also have a new debt, they have a liability, they have to pay it back eventually. But while they have hold of that money, the money supply is increased. Okay, so it's important to keep in mind that fractional reserve bank creates new money, but not new wealth. Okay, it redistributes wealth from some to other people, some people to other people. Then we can look at the sequence of what goes on here. The person who borrowed the $90, let's say to add equipment to his dry cleaning establishment or something, then goes and pays the money to someone else, and that person deposits it in the Second National Bank. Okay, so the first person borrowed from the First National Bank. He deposits the $90 in the Second National Bank, and you see what happens. Second National Bank only has to hold 10%, so it immediately sets aside $9, but will lend out the $81 at interest. Okay. So now you have an additional $81 in the economy. In addition to the 90 additional dollars, you now have 81. Okay. And then that person may go and spend it on a restaurant meal or treating his friends to a restaurant meal. The restaurateur has his own bank. He takes $81, deposits it, and you see where this is all going. Okay, that bank only needs to hold 10% or about around $8 and can lend out the rest. So the money supply continues to increase, and we'll see that this will go on and on. Okay, profits will continue. At each step, at each round, the amount the bank lends will be smaller and smaller, So the increases in the money supply will be lower and lower, okay? And they'll approach zero. It's called it'll approach but never reach zero. And that's called an infinite geometric progression. And so the total money supply, okay, will now tend towards $1,000, okay? So because $100 of reserves that is put into the banking system by the initial depositors can support, in a fractional reserve banking system, 10 times the amount, okay? Because $100 is 10% of $1,000. So you'll have, in the economy now, $1,000. The money supply will have increased tenfold. Now, there's reasons why it doesn't increase tenfold. But there's a simple, which we'll come to, but there's a simple formula for determining what we call this money multiplier. So the money multiplier is the amount of money the banking system generates with each new dollar of reserves. And it's an equation, a formula, that is derived from that that step-by-step process that I showed you. And I'm not going to derive it for you here, but it's 1 divided by the reserve ratio. And so if that's 10%, then the money multiplier is equal to 1 over 10% or 1 over 0.10, and that equals 10. So $100 of reserves creates $1,000 of money, okay? Which is to say that $100 the reserves over the money supply or over deposits of $1,000 is 10%. Okay, now here's a more realistic balance sheet. I'm not going to do much with this, but just show it to you. Banks not only accept deposits, but they also hold debt. That is, they'll issue bonds, and they'll have stockholders, shareholders. And so that'll be the capital, okay? So on the right side, the liabilities have to equal assets. So on the right side, we have $1,000 of liabilities. And notice the assets, the bank has reserves of 200, which is 25%, which means they may very well keep excess reserves. They'll loan out $700, and they'll buy government securities worth $100, because government securities can be sold very, very quickly in case people rush to withdraw their money. You can sell some securities and get more reserves pretty quickly, where it's much harder to pull in loans. You know, some loans will come due for 30 years, other loans will come due in a few months, and so on. But securities can be liquidated right away in exchange for reserves. And that's what we call the leverage ratio, okay? The ratio of, again, this is not as important as what I've been teaching up to this point, but just to keep in mind, if you see the term leverage, it's the ratio of assets to bank capital, okay? So the bank had $1,000 of assets, and the shareholders only invested $50 in capital. So the leverage ratio is 20, okay? So the bank's owners own $1 in, rather let's put it this way, for every $20, only $1 has come from the direct investment by the shareholders. The other 19 has been financed with the money of investors or depositors. So that leverage enormously amplifies profits and losses. And this is why fractional reserve banking is so profitable. So let's assume that all the bank assets go up by 5%. Well, 5% of 1,000 is $50, okay? And the bank capital doubles. In other words, the depositors, I'm sorry, not the depositors, the owners of the bank, the shareholders, double their equity. They get a 100% capital gain. Okay. On the other hand, though, if the bank assets decrease by 55% only, okay, they're wiped out. Okay, if it, by more than 5%, then there's the bank's insolvent. It goes bankrupt. So now let's get to central banks. For central banks, without going into too much detail, if there were the fractional reserve banking system, without a central bank to bail them out, I would argue, and Murray Rothbard and von Mises argued the same thing, the fractional reserve banks, let's say if there were free banks in the true sense of the word, where no one would bail them out in the case of a problem, a bank run, they would go out of business pretty quickly, or they would learn to keep almost 100% reserves. Okay, but now when the central bank steps in, and the first central bank originated in Great Britain in 1692, and was not a complete central bank, but it was a privileged bank. And the government set it up so that the central bank could loan paper money to the government, with which they could pay their bills, build palaces, fight wars, and so on. So central banks are part of interventionist, militaristic policies. That's how they grew up. So the central bank oversees the banking system, so they put regulations on the banking system, and they regulate money supply. And that's what monetary policy is. It's really, it's not the setting of interest rates, it's the controlling of interest rates, as Bernanke continually tells us. In fact, what it is it's the determination of the amount of money in the economy using the fractional reserve banking system, okay, and using certain tools that the Fed has to alter the amount of deposits in the economy. Okay, and our central bank is the Federal Reserve System, or simply the Fed. Okay. Okay, and that's a pretty scary picture there. So he just stepped out of the shower, or he's tortured about having all these QE programs that he thinks are going to go, you know, blow up his face, and hopefully they will. I think they will. But that's the structure there. I'm not even going to read it through, but. Any money and banking textbook, and this is not a money and banking course, will have a chapter on the structure of the Fed. So let me just introduce the most important tool. It's called tool monetary policy, or instrument. Okay, but the most important tool by which the Fed influences the reserves, and that is called open market operations, which is kind of a fancy name for the fact that the Fed goes into the financial markets and either buys bonds or sells bonds. Okay, and it used to be, before the financial crisis, they were government, almost wholly government bonds, though they could buy and sell foreign government bonds also. And this is how they create, this is the main tool they use to create money. So if the Fed buys a bond from a bank, okay, It deposits new reserves in the bank's account. Most of the bank's reserves are not in the ATM machines and in the vault, by the way. They're at the regional Federal Reserve Bank, and there are 12 regional banks. So my bank in New Jersey would hold most of its reserves in an account at the New York Federal Reserve Bank. Okay, and that's called a reserve account. So if a bank in New Jersey sells a bond to the Fed, for $10 million, what the Fed does is simply with a few keystrokes, creates in cyberspace $10 million new dollars of reserves. Okay, now how does the Fed do that? Well, just because it's the Fed, it's legally permitted to, it creates it out of thin air in cyberspace. Okay, so the bank is now told that they have $10 million more in their reserves, and they're not, and so those are excess reserves. They're not backing up any deposits. The Fed just simply created them out of thin air, and so then they go and lend out the full $10 million. And then the money multiplier kicks in as the borrowers then borrow and we spend it, and it's loaned out by, and it's deposited and loaned out by other banks. And then, to make a long story short, you can get a maximum of $100 million new dollars in the economy from that $10 million bond purchased by the Fed, because they've introduced $10 million more of reserves, which can support $100 million. Now, there are many reasons why you don't get the full maximum increase in the money supply, that you might only get $2.50 for every dollar and not $10 for every new dollar of reserves. And the Fed can decrease the money supply. If it sells a bond for $10 million, well, then the bank that buys it has to pay with a check, okay? And what the Fed does is reduce the balance of reserves in the bank's reserve account by $10 million. So then what happens when the bank's loans come in, when loans are come due, they cannot make those loans again because they don't have sufficient reserves, okay? And that reduces the money supply, okay? Okay, I will stop here. There's a few more tools we'll talk about next week. involving how the Fed creates money, and we'll then go on to the next topic after that. But I will now take any questions. Let me see. One question here is, somebody asked, what are the reasons that the Fed does not utilize the full multiplier effect? There's a number of reasons. When banks hold excess reserves, that means that money does not get loaned out, does not get into the multiplier process. When you or I, when we get some of the new money, let's say somebody spends the money in, on your business or my business or hires me, we don't redeposit all the money in our bank either, so they don't get the full amount of reserves in the second or third round. We hold some in currency. So there are leakages. It's called leakages into excess reserves, leakages into currency. And that's why you don't get the full effect of the multiplier. Okay. And today, but certainly you're not getting the full effect of the multiplier because the banks are holding such a great amount of excess reserves. Someone asked an important question here. What is the difference between money and currency? Okay, so yeah, there's a very specific meaning of both money and currency among economists. Okay, in popular language, sometimes you use currency to mean money, but that's to be technically correct. Money includes currency and other and bank accounts. Okay, now economists disagree. We talk about this about what should be included. What kinds of bank accounts should be included as part of the money supply, and I would include not only checking accounts, but also savings accounts, okay, as part of the money supply. So money is the broader concept. Currency is a very narrow concept. It applies only to the paper Federal Reserve dollars and also the token coin, nickels, dimes, quarters that you hold. That's currency. Okay, I already answered the question of how the money supply increases other than just printing more. It increases, as I said, when the Fed buys bonds and creates reserves out of thin air, and the banks then begin to loan that money out by creating checking accounts for the borrowers. So initially, there's no printing of currency to increase the money supply. Later on, as people as that money is spent and people begin to want to hold some of that money in the form of currency, at that point, they withdraw currency from the ATMs and so on, and the banks have to replace that by trading some of their reserves in for currency that the Fed then shifts to them. Okay, has the Treasury prints off and the Fed shifts. Okay. Someone asked if reserve requirements still relevant since. We have a negative reserve rate, meaning that I guess that money is paid on reserves. No, they're relevant as a minimum, okay? But banks are holding more right now. But that does not mean that the money multiplier does not work, okay? The money multiplier is less, okay, than it would be if all those excess reserves were loaned out. You'd have an explosive increase in the money supply if more than $1 trillion of excess reserves were loaned out. Someone else asked that in the following. In the mystery of banking, Rothbard explains that in phase one of an inflationary process, everyone is hoarding cash. And so the question is, first, do you think that we are in this phase now when we see banks and companies keeping high excess reserves? No, I don't think we. Ross was talking about something a little bit different there. Okay, it's as follows. For example, it usually happens when you're used to a price level that hasn't changed for a long period of time. So, for example, when World War I broke out, most countries were on the gold standard. Prices were falling. So, when all governments went off the gold standard within the first 2 weeks, all belligerents went off the gold standard within the first 2 weeks of the outbreak of World War I. And they began printing money to pay for the war because they tried to raise taxes to the full amount. There would have been revolutions in all those countries. I mean, people would just refuse to pay. Because war is incredibly expensive, so governments have to hide it to inflation. And they've done it throughout history. So anyway, when people see prices rising in wartime, they believe that those prices are abnormal. And that eventually, after the war, and they thought the war was going to be short, after the war, prices are going to fall to their normal level. So if you think prices are going to go down in 6 months or a year or a year and a half, you will not spend the money now. You'll wait until the money has a greater purchasing power in the future. Okay? So that's what Rothbard is talking about. Before people expect inflation to be chronic and to go on and prices to be higher year after year, they think the first phase when they think that it's abnormally high prices and that prices will fall, and so that, you know what? They say to themselves, I will hold this money and wait until prices are lower, and then I'll buy the car, and then I'll buy, you know, whatever item I want to buy. Okay? So they'll only buy things like food. And they'll hold off on big expenditures that can be postponed. Okay. Someone asked a question or make a statement that they were surprised by the fact that in Rothbard's Mystery of Banking, he used equilibrium models to explain how prices are achieved in a market economy. I thought that Austrian economists didn't use the equilibrium model because it doesn't explain the market as a process, and following Hayek erroneously assumes that all the information is known. So my question is the following. What is the actual position of Austrian economists in this matter? I can't go into it in great detail, but what I can say is that the type of equilibrium that Rothbard uses is the moment-to-moment equilibrium. Okay, and that equilibrium occurs continually. All it means is that at any given moment in time, with their given knowledge, with the knowledge that people have, when people go on into a market, they will make all the exchanges that are beneficial to them. So, for example, if you stand outside of Walmart and watch as people come out with their different items in their baskets and go to their cars, let's say for an hour. So during that hour, there's an equilibrium, and it's in the following sense that the prices that were paid, the equilibrium prices, because people bought all that they desired or all the goods that they believed exceeded their prices, and Walmart sold all those goods that they thought had a lower value than the price that they got in exchange. Okay, Walmart held an inventory; they held some of those goods for the following day, and so they set sort of a reservation price. Okay, or we think of an auction. When the prices are bid up to the point where there's only if there's only one unit of supply of a good at auction, there's one seller, that is an equilibrium price. The supply equals demand for that moment in time, okay, in that market. So when Austrians use the term equilibrium, they mean market clearing equilibrium. That at that moment in time, with the amount of knowledge that people have and with their expectations of what the future will bring, they make all the exchanges, both parties make all the exchanges that are mutually beneficial. So anyone who doesn't buy something in Walmart and walks out without that thing is also in equilibrium because that person believes that the value of what he would be getting is actually lower than the price. Okay? So that's important. It's not a trivial concept. Okay? That's how Austrian economists use the term. Hayek made the mistake of thinking that Austrians meant more than that. He had in mind what's called, I don't want to go into technical detail, but Walrasian equilibrium. Equilibrium in which the whole market is adjusted and there are no profits and losses. And that's not the kind of equilibrium that the Austrians are talking about. Whatever prices are paid at any given moment, there always are going to be profits and losses to be made. And in fact, it's those profits and losses which bring people into the market the next day. Okay? As more supply of some goods and less of other goods, and people's wants change, and then there's a new equilibrium. But Bombazark, who's a Mises teacher, called this momentary equilibrium. And Benger, who was Bombazark's teacher and the first Austrian, call this type of equilibrium momentary states of rest. So that's the kind of equilibrium that we need. Okay, and that's supply and demand of for money is the same thing. Okay, doesn't mean that the price level is not going to change in an hour or tomorrow. The purchasing power will change. This is a discussion?
Yeah, well, these are the questions.
Okay, okay.
And
okay.
The chat.
Okay. Okay. Okay, why haven't we seen more inflation with the Fed printing all the new money? Okay, that's a very good question. The Fed doesn't print reserves, okay? What we call, the Fed increases the monetary base. Okay, the monetary base equals the reserves that banks hold. Okay, and if those reserves aren't loaned out, they don't become a part of the overall money supply. Okay, they're just what the monetary base is, what the money supply is based on. Okay, also part of the monetary base is currency. Okay, but the Fed only prints currency in response to the demand of people who are want currency instead of check accounts. Okay, so even though the Fed is increasing the monetary base, because of excess reserves, it's not being transformed into circulating money that is part of the money supply that you and I use. Someone asks, considering that we pay income taxes and other taxes, has anyone ever calculated the range of taxation we have when you include the expropriation due to fractional reserve banking? I'm not sure of that. I mean, economists have tried to calculate the amount of seigniorage, that's the amount that is earned that you get, the amount of revenue that you realize from printing new money. That has been calculated, okay? I don't know what the latest figures are on that. But, for example, I think the U.S., in history has gotten 3% of its tax revenues from seigniorage, meaning the printing of money. Okay, whereas some other countries, inflationary countries, may get 50% or 70% of their tax revenues from money printing. The banks run around and buy stocks with their new money, thereby inflating the price of stock. The commercial banks still are not permitted to directly buy stocks. Okay, they can't invest in stocks. They can invest in bonds and of different types, both government and corporate bonds, but mortgages and of course loans. But they can't buy stocks. But they used to be able to make brokers loans. They can loan to brokers who then will use stocks as collateral. There's a question that Rothbard says that inflation of the money supply causes a rise in the standard of living. Then does this mean that deflation causes a reduction in standard of living? If so, how does this play out differently than the rise of the standard of living? I don't think Rothbard says that the money supply causes a rise in the standard of living. The standard of living is the actual goods and services that you enjoy, okay, in exchange for your labor, in exchange for your real income. That is, that real incomes go up. Inflation doesn't cause real incomes to go up throughout the economy. It does cause some people to have an increase in their standard of living at the expense of other people, okay. That is the people who receive the new money first. They're able to buy more goods and services than before, whereas other people who get the money later on are unable to afford, during the period before they get the money, they're unable to afford to buy as much as they have. So their real incomes actually fall for a period until they get the new money, and then once they do, then they're able to pay the higher prices and they go back to their old standard of living. Okay? So during the interim, some people have an increased standard of living at the expense of other people. It's a very good question. Although we speak of a doubling in the money supply, doubling prices. Is it correct to assume that Austrian economics doesn't use this as a linear rule? All we know is that prices would be higher than they otherwise would be, right? There's no exact formula. Absolutely correct. There's no exact formula. That's a monetarist belief that you can somehow, at least in the long run, say that if you double the money supply, after all short-run adjustments are complete, you're going to double prices. Austrians say even in the long run, you're not going to double prices. Some prices will rise more than other prices, and some prices might even fall as real income is diverted away from people who buy certain goods and towards others that buy different goods. So you'll have the whole range of changes in prices. If you average them out, the average doesn't matter, by the way. The average, you Austrians don't look at average price levels. We look at all prices, okay? So the Austrians think of price levels, or as prices in general, not as a price level, but you can think of it, one Austrian economist, American economist, who was sort of sympathetic to the Austrians, called it a price swarm, like a swarm of bees. When bees rise or fall, okay, the swarm of bees that are flying, they change positions, okay? So you can't really exact, so they all change positions. So relative prices are changing. Some bees are going lower than other bees. And the swarm itself may go up or down. We can tell that if it goes up and down in history, it goes up or down in general, okay? But there's no exact formula, okay? So when these bees go up or go down, you don't know exactly, you know, how the price will change over time, or rather the positions of the bees will change over time with respect to one another. And that's what the Austrians believe. There is no formula. Are casino chips a part of the money supply? They're absolutely not part of the money supply, okay? Casino chips, if the casino goes out of business, they don't redeem the chips. You can't use the chips outside the casino, or you may be able to in limited places outside of the casino. So they may be a medium of exchange. I'm not denying that. I mean, if people in Las Vegas are willing to accept the chips at core value, and that might not even be the case, if they're willing to give you the full amount of the chips, it's only limited in any case. It could be a local medium of exchange. I'm not denying that. But that is not part of the money supply. That is not people in, you know, Iowa, if you try to sell them the chips, they would not accept them, or if they did, they would only accept them at 50% of their face value. So that is not part of the money supply. Anything can be local media of exchange. Okay, so someone asked, how does the Treasury know how much money to physically create and destroy? When a bank makes a new loan, do they ask the U.S. Treasury for the cash to give to their client? So the Treasury is really sort of relying on the Fed. What happens is that as currency wears out, the Fed will return it to the Treasury. The Treasury will destroy the currency and replace it with new currency. Okay, so banks will turn in worn currency, and it will be destroyed and replaced. That's a very mechanical, technical operation. And when banks loan money out, no, they don't ask for necessarily ask for more currency. In fact, as I said, if you or I put $100 into a, let's say I put $10,000 into a bank account, what occurs is the bank has $10,000 more reserves, and in the modern world, the bank doesn't actually lend out the currency I've put in there. Okay, what they do is they create a checking account for $9,000 because they can bank hold 10% of $100. Okay, and so they create that checking account for $9,000, and then the borrower will then spend it and so on, and people will write checks on that bank, and eventually that currency will leak out from the bank. Okay, but they don't ask the Fed for more currency immediately. Has there been any value created out of econometrics, like better decision-making, management of resources? And if not, then why is the course even taught? Well, this is a little bit off the topic. I don't think that there's really a lot of value to econometrics. I mean, You can use econometrics to do some historical studies and see what, how much of a, an impact certain things have on other things. There's a good book by Austrian sympathetic economist, Veteran Galloway, called Out of Work, which shows that as wages went up, these econometric studies show that as wages went up during the Great Depression, unemployment increased and the recession deepened. I think simple econometrics like that, you know, is valuable in showing us some of the magnitudes of the effects in economic history, because economics can never give us an exact formula, okay, that if you increase wage rates by 10%, unemployment will increase by 3%. We can't say that. But you can look back and try to estimate by how much wage rates increased and by how much that affected unemployment. Well, because that happened in the 30s, though, that formula doesn't hold for today. They find out every 5% increase in wage rates caused a 2% decrease, increase in unemployment. That's okay, that's fine, and that gives us knowledge, historical knowledge, but it doesn't give us any formula for figuring out the, what an increase in wage rates will cause to happen to unemployment today. Another question is, during the crisis, the Fed indiscriminately bought assets from willing sellers because they did so at par. To shrink the money supply, can the Fed force the banks to buy its impaired assets? What if the banks prefer to hold cash? Cash is safer than bonds. Well, I don't think the Fed would force them to buy the assets back. The Fed could sell the assets on the open market, but if they do that, they'll sell them at a big, big discount. Okay? And it will be clear that the Fed lost money. Let's put it this way, that the Fed overpaid the banks for taking these bad assets off their hands. I don't think the Fed would want to force them back on the banks right now, because that would weaken the banks themselves. Okay? So the Fed actually purchased the assets. The Fed owns them. So you know, they can't force someone to take they'd be Indian givers. They can't force the bank to give them money back and them to take the assets. But they can't sell them on the market. So that's how they would unwind. You know, if the bank started lending out excess reserves, the Fed would hope to be able to sell off some of their portfolio of assets. Okay, so when they sell, remember, people have to pay with checks that they've written on their banks, and then the banks would lose reserves back to the Fed. Okay, so they don't have to force the banks to take the bad assets. They can sell them on the market, and then when the checks are written on the banks, the bank's reserves will go down, and then we'll be able to loan out as much. There's a question that refers to a Reuters article. Davos leaders uneasy over the glut of easy money. And then the person asked, tied by its own rules and German resistance, European Central Bank cannot join the downward currency race, raising the risk that an overvalued euro chokes off any economic recovery. Why would they say this, or what does an Austrian say? Well, basically, an Austrian says that, you know, the Germans, in this case, are right, that they're not inflating their money supply to try to push down the value of their currency. There are other things they can do to hasten a recovery. They can cut taxes. They can cut government spending. They can get rid of a lot of regulations, and that will increase production in the German economy. They don't have to depend on exports alone. That's just this idea that we can devalue our monetary unit, make it less valuable in terms of foreign currencies, and sell more. That's basically giving away the country. In other words, sure, if you make your currency very, very cheap, foreigners will buy up all the things in your country. So you and I, as consumers, let's say in the U.S., will have to pay a lot higher prices. There'll be a lot fewer goods available. Okay. So when the currency was very cheap in the 1980s, the Japanese bought up the Chrysler Building in New York. They bought up Pebble Beach Golf Course. They bought up a lot of land in the U.S. Okay, so that's not the way to recover. That's the rational way to recover. That causes inflation and it hurts American citizens when you deliberately to value the purchasing power of their dollar. They can afford only fewer imports from foreign countries and so on. Monetarists like Steve Hanke argued that we could dramatically improve the economy if the Fed would target a rate of growth of M3 or Divisia M4, which is another kind of money supply, the Divisia index, which are largely stagnant over time since the crisis. How do Austrians respond to this claim? Well, first, in a couple of ways, we reject these very broad aggregates that include a lot of investments, okay, or credit, okay, things that are not part of the money supply. And secondly, increasing the money supply right now actually makes things worse because it keeps, well, part of the problem is that our assets are overpriced. The Fed has not allowed the housing market to adjust to the underlying forces of supply and demand. It hasn't allowed the stock market to adjust. You know, so we've had a stock market hitting 5-year highs recently. Commodities prices are extremely high. All of this because there is an increase in the money supply. Okay, despite the fact that banks are holding excess reserves, the money supply is still increasing at, especially the Austrian money supply, at rates that are driving prices up. Okay, so the Austrians would deny that this is a road to recovery. It's just another Keynesian measure in a way that will distort the economy even more and set us up for. I mean, we have another stock market bubble basically now, and they're trying to create another housing bubble. So it's going to set, and also agricultural land in the Midwest has hit highs, okay? So that's eventually going to collapse, those types of bubbles. In the real world, which industries get the benefits of higher purchasing power? Who does it harm the most? Well, it depends on where the new money goes first. Okay, recently, you know, with the bailout of the investment sector or the financial sector, it's clear who got the new money. Okay, the managers and the stockholders, the bondholders that were holding the assets that went bad. Okay, had loaned money to financial institutions or who held stock in these financial institutions, they were bailed out. The managers who are earning high salaries, they got the benefit of the new money. In a normal situation, the military industrial complex gets the benefit. Boeing aircraft gets the benefit. They build a lot of military aircraft for the government. Silicon Valley firms that build, you know, computers for the government. Bureaucrats of these continually proliferating agencies get the new money. That's why the highest housing prices in the country, are in the area in Virginia and Maryland that are surround Washington D.C. And they never really had a collapse of their housing bubble at all. Okay, that money keeps just flowing in. And you can go on and on. There are many special interests. Farmers, for example, big agribusiness, ConAgra, and there's a number of others. That get the new money. They're subsidized to farm agricultural programs and so on. Who are the winners or losers? Who are the winners and losers, excuse me, when the money supply rises or falls, and how does the rise fall of money supply reverberate throughout the economy? Who has written detail about the winners and losers? Well, I mean, you might want to look at you know, even Rothbard's works, certainly his history of money, U.S. money, banking, money and banking in the U.S. from the colonial era, excuse me, to World War II. And look at, you know, how some of the bankers, obviously, the first ones to get the new money, the investment bankers also, as well as the commercial bankers, so they benefit. And you can look at some of Bob Higgs' work on war and crises and so on, and how the new money goes to the military industrial complex. He's written a number of books where he points this out. So there are a lot of these works on economic history, Austrian-oriented works, in which these things are pointed out. Okay, last question. Do factors outside the Fed, like the 2007 increase in minimum wage laws, price increases, et cetera, cause recession to begin, or are rising interest rates predominantly the major factor? I would say not rising interest rates, of course, but the fact that the seeds of the recession are always sown when interest rates decline or are artificially depressed by the new money. Now, you're right, the person who asked this question, that interest rates shoot up when the Fed stops printing as much money as it had been before. And that precipitates depression or recession. But that's not the ultimate cause. The ultimate cause is actually the previous inflation and depression of interest rates, the driving them down below what we call the natural level. And there was another part of that question. Minimum wage laws certainly add to recessionary symptoms. Okay, it piles teenage unemployment on top of cyclical unemployment. That's unemployment caused by recession. So I will stop here, and I will see you next week. Thank you again for attending.